Now, we make decisions every day, from things as small as what shirt to wear to bigger things, like whether or not to take out that second mortgage. Recent science has started to unravel the inner workings of how we really make decisions, and it might surprise you.
Gemma Tarlak joins us now. She's a senior editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha, and she joins us about once a month to share the latest science news. Gemma, welcome back to Central Time. Gemma, you with us? No, you're there. I'm sure we'll be able to hear you in just a second. Gemma, are you with us?
Yes, I'm
there.
Here.
There we go. Yeah. I knew you were there. Excellent. Lovely to
wow,
hear your voice, though.
Keeping me on my toes.
Deciding whether or not to answer. No, I think that was on our end, actually.
Well, now that you're with us, Gemma, let's talk about the science of decision making. This is something that you have a piece about in Discover Magazine. What have we learned about the latest to how we make decisions?
Yeah, this is really fascinating because I think most of us like to think that we're kind of a little bit Spockish when it comes to decision making. You know, we weigh the pros and the cons, and we choose based on experience and everything. And over time, researchers have found that humans can be incredibly irrational about how they make decisions. But at the same time, we can make decisions based on, it's not even irrationality. It's based on these subconscious ideas and experiences that we don't even know that we have.
Right. I've read, and I read in the piece and discovered that some people are really good at making gut decisions on the spur of the moment, but that's usually only if they have years and years of experience on that subject.
Right, right. It's kind of like muscle memory in a trained boxer. You know, they're not thinking, oh, this guy's coming in this way, I'm going to hit him this way. It's called pattern matching. And it's basically, it's an analysis that occurs without even our knowledge, taking in the sensory information that and then matching it to past experiences. And this theory really came to light after a researcher looked at how first responders and military commanders were making decisions. And especially among the more experienced of these individuals, he found that they seemed to make these snap judgments rather than carefully weighing the pros and cons. And that's because, without even thinking about it, they were using pattern matching. It was all occurring without them sitting down and thinking about it. They were just doing it instantaneously almost, much like, as I mentioned, a muscle memory.
So what happens with the rest of us maybe when we don't have 20 years of muscle memory on any given field and we have to make a decision? What kinds of decisions do we end up making?
Well, they found basically that the prevailing theory is that we really make decisions based on one of two systems. And system one, you can think of it as the snap judgment system. It's very quick. It's automatic. You don't stop to weigh the pros and cons. And it can be very valuable, but it's also very vulnerable to biases that you might not know you have. So, you know, for example, oh, that guy, he's got long hair. He must be up to no good.
Hey, wait a minute.
I'm just giving you an example. Just giving you an example. But, you know, or for me, if I see someone driving a certain type of car, this is terrible, but a certain make and model of car, I think, oh, man, that guy is going to try to cut me off. You know, that's like another example that has nothing to do with hair. So those are very snap judgments, and they tend to be very fast and more emotional. Sometimes it's called implicit knowledge, and it's the result of connecting. This is the sciencey, super sciencey part of it. It's the result of connections between groups of neurons that form during repeated exposure. And that's why we think, oh, that guy looks like an ex-boyfriend that I don't like, so I'm not going to like him, or he's a bad guy. You know, it's that kind of judgment area. But system two, in terms of decision-making, that is the Spock decision-making process. It's analytical, it's deliberate, it's weighing the pros and cons, and that can be very valuable for, if example, you are thinking about taking out that second mortgage. The problem is it takes more time and more brain power to do. So if you're in a situation where you have, you know, say a reckless driver coming at you head on and you have to pick which is the best way to avoid him, you don't want to really engage in that slow, deliberative process.
And even in less of a crisis situation, I've certainly been here, I think a lot of people have, where you start weighing the pros and cons of a decision, buying a new appliance or whatever, and you can really quickly go down a rabbit hole and end up with no decision at all. And ultimately, it comes back to that snap judgment system anyway.
I think sometimes, sure, for some people, you know, we all make our decisions a little bit differently. But what really fascinated me was that this theory of System 1 and System 2 emerged in the late 20th century. But if you go all the way back to ancient Greece and Plato, you know, he didn't get everything right, but he got a few things right. Plato actually compared human will and decision-making to a charioteer with two horses, one representing rational impulses and the other representing irrational passions. So even back in ancient Greece, Plato was kind of on to the System 1, System 2 duality of our decision-making process.
We're talking with Gemma Tarlak right now from Discover Magazine, getting caught up on the latest in science news. And Gemma, forensic evidence is big on TV, but we don't realize sometimes it goes back a long way. We're going to talk about some of the latest stuff, but first, can you tell us about that very first example of a kind of forensic investigation in China?
Yeah, and I love this, and I can't believe there isn't like a CSI in medieval China yet, but... Basically, a field worker in 13th century China was unfortunately killed with a sickle. And everyone in the village had a sickle, and they all looked alike. So the investigator trying to find the killer had every worker lay their tool down in a field. And he found that only one sickle was attracting blowflies, which seek out blood. And so he said, yep, this is the sickle, and its owner confessed. So that's kind of like the earliest CSI episode ever, 13th century China. Mm. We've progressed quite a bit since then, I'm happy to say.
Now, there's been some controversy about recent forensic evidence, people putting too much faith in it, but we're starting to get new with DNA and other things, new and what are hopefully more reliable indicators that can help tell a story of what happened in a crime and hopefully solve it.
Yeah, and you know what I love about this field is it's going in so many different directions, but they're all really interesting, and they're all pretty rigorous science-wise. So, for example, the microbial clock. You know, you always see on Law & Order, I don't know about you, but I kind of binge-watch the Law & Order marathons. I seriously have a problem with that, but they're always like, the first thing they ask is, well, when is the body in rigor? How long, you know, has the body been there? Because what's the state of rigor mortis? And that's not really precise. There are a couple other ways to tell how long a body has been there, when was a person was killed, but they're all not that precise. Now, however, scientists are working out a microbial clock, and basically the microbes inside the body go through this very regular, consistent pattern in terms of which microbes are present and what they're doing. And so using this newly developed microbial clock, they are able to tell within 2 to 4 days over a 25-day period of when the body was put at the spot, either when the individual was killed there or even if the individual was moved from another spot. And, you know, it's a gruesome thing to talk about, but at the same time, how great is it that we're getting closer to really being able to find people who have done terrible things?
And Gemma, before we move on to our last topic, there's some new stuff there also with augmented reality, right?
Yeah. You know, the great thing is all of these new techniques involving microbes and now using protein identification the same way we kind of use DNA, these are all super high-tech, super important to make sure that they are collected from the crime scene without contamination. But you don't want 50, 60, 70 people traipsing through your crime scene, one guy picking up the proteins, one guy picking up this. So what they're using now is augmented reality, and they're starting this program in the Netherlands. And what they're doing is basically sending the crime scene investigator to the scene of the crime with kind of a body cam, if you want to think about it that way, plus a wrist monitor. So he is interacting with remote experts, potentially anywhere in the world, who can see what he's seeing, who can type him notes in real time, who can even mark on the monitor, hey, we want you to take a second look at this spot, or hey, let's make sure we dust for prints on this spot. So it really opens up the crime scene without bringing a lot of people actually to the crime scene and potentially contaminating it.
And Gemma, finally, you wrote about a mystery 350 million years in the making, when our first ancestors came out of the water onto land. What's the state of the art in terms of when, why, and how that happened?
Well, we don't know exactly when, And we don't know exactly which animal, but we're starting to really piece together how. And quite frankly, this is a huge moment in evolution, because when these aquatic animals moved onto land and became fully terrestrial, and we're talking about vertebrates here, they evolved, talk about a diverse bunch, they evolved into dinosaurs, birds, mammals, amphibians, everything pretty much with a spine on the land came from these tetrapods that were moving onto land around 365 million years ago. And basically, we're figuring out in new fossil hotspots, like in southern Scotland in particular, we're figuring out really how they came to land. And they may have been washed in a storm surge, or they may have been living in these river systems where there's a lot of fluctuation in the water level. And it's just fascinating stuff. And they just found 12 new species. In December, they published the results. So every day, we're learning more and more about it.
Well, we'll have to talk more about that. Gemma, thanks a lot for joining us today. It's always fun.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
That was Gemma Tarlak, senior editor at Discover Magazine. She joins us about once a month to share some of the coolest news from the world of science.